Previously on Beta.
Do you seriously expect me to tell the president that an alien has landed, assumed the identity of a dead house painter from Madison, Wisconsin?
No, I've never actually driven an asphalt mixer per se, but I did once drive my friend's van to Wisconsin on a pretty lengthy road trip.
Well, I went to Wisconsin for both undergrad and grad school. Go Badgers.
Boo, Indiana Hoosiers.
No, Badgers.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. David Lynch is one of the most original filmmakers out there, and I do mean out there. His films are so distinctive and so surreal that we even have an adjective to describe them. Lynchian.
On the surface, Lynchian is funny because there's this element of the surreal to things that are Lynchian. But the deepest, most important part of Lynchian is beauty and embracing things that at a glance might be dismissed as ugly.
Christine McKenna collaborated with Lynch to write a book that offers us an all-access pass into the life and mind of one of the most visionary auteurs in cinema history. Also, my beautiful, dark, twisted fantasy. It's a phrase that you could use to describe many of David Lynch's movies, but it's also the name of Kanye West's critically acclaimed album.
He's exploring self-doubt, and I think that willingness to go to those places and that willingness to really cling to vulnerability like a plank after a shipwreck, I think that people relate to that.
Kirk Walker Graves takes us on a tour of Kanye West's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, an album that NPR music critic Ann Powers described as, quote, Picasso-like, fulfilling the cubist mandate of rearranging form, texture, color, and space to suggest new ways of viewing things. End quote. But let's kick things off with Amber Ruffin. Amber is a comedy writer and a comedian. She's worked on Late Night with Seth Meyers since 2014. When she got that gig, she made history. She became the first Black woman to write for an American late night network talk show. Amber is the co-creator of the popular segments Jokes Seth Can't Tell and Amber Says What? We talked about her pioneering work for Late Night, her passion for writing musicals, and her audition for Saturday Night Live.
I know that a lot of people just did stand-up, but I was told to do three characters you made up and three impressions. And I did trying to put Janelle Monáe to bed.
Uh-huh.
And a Somalian sommelier.
Oh yeah, that's good. Can you do a bit of that or not? Or is it too hard?
I will absolutely not.
Okay. All right. Can't blame me for asking. That's great. I love that. So the Somalian sommelier. Yeah, that's great. Were you happy with how the audition went?
I was very happy with it. I thought I did a great job. But I mean, I kind of have that, kind of outlook on everything.
Oh yeah,
I thought I did great.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't good enough.
Yeah. So, how did you feel when you got the phone call that you didn't get the gig?
Dude, when they told me I didn't get it, I was shocked. I just really thought I was going to get it, and it is so funny because that was kind of how I found out that I was a very cocky person.
Yeah?
Like, to think that I was so shocked. I thought for sure I had it, which is great, because I needed to be taken down a peg, and now I'm perfectly normal.
Why do you think you needed to be taken down a peg? Because you were so cocky?
I was.
Yeah?
I really was. I really thought I had it. I don't know what my problem was. I think, you know, I had over-prepared, so I was so comfortable.
Yeah, you put so much blood, sweat, and tears and angst into it, so much stuff into it that you. But then a short while later, it kind of ended up being a good thing that you didn't get the SNL gig because you got a phone call from Seth Meyers. Tell me about that.
And I think it was 2 days later that Seth called and offered me the job, but he called so quickly after that I thought he was calling to say, I'm sorry you didn't get SNL.
Yeah.
So I kept saying, you didn't have to call, man.
Yeah.
But he was trying to offer me a job.
And the gig, of course, was as a writer for his late night talk show. So you made history when you accepted this gig. You became the first Black woman to write for a late night network talk show in America. What did that mean to you? What does that mean to you?
It never occurred to me that I would ever be a first anything.
Mm.
But, you know, it's so cool. You forget how recent all of our nation's atrocities are until there's the next person who's like the first Black anything. You're like, oh yeah, everything was ready to go, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'll talk to my mom, you know, about voting. You know, she couldn't always vote. And like mm-hmm. my dad couldn't always eat everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you don't really think about that until something like that happens. Then you're like, oh yes, that was just 1 minute ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you feel a lot of pressure to serve as a role model and a trailblazer because of the fact that you're this historic first?
No, absolutely not. I would if the job wasn't to act a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And my job is to literally act a fool. So there is no real wrong way you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I could be like, you know what? I love cops and I think they act justly. I suppose I could, you know, I could do things that way.
Yeah.
But I'm just so not that type of person that I feel pretty good.
Yeah. I find that interesting that you use that phrase, your job description is to literally act a fool. What do you mean by that?
I mean, if it makes you giggle while you're doing it,
mm-hmm.
it's probably good for the show.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Like that story of Kermit Patty, I think they called her, that white woman who called the cops on that child for selling water.
Yeah,
came on the
with a license,
of
yeah.
Barbecue Becky, who called the cops on those people for barbecuing.
Yeah.
So I wrote a goofy version of Rockwell's Someone's Watching Me. That, I feel like, you know, while, you know, Jenny dressed as Barbecue Becky and Allie dressed as Kermit Patty dance around. And I feel like that's the silliest thing I could possibly think of.
When I'm at a barbecue, even in a public place, I break into a sweat when Becky looks me in the face. She says she's on the phone. Will her staring ever stop? Does she want to do me in or does she want my pork chops? When I'm selling water for a trip to Disneyland, Patty says I need a permit, unlike a white kid's lemonade stand. People say I'm crazy, a little touched in the brain. But if you ask me, it's these white women who are insane, because I always feel like white women watching me. And I got no privacy. Oh, I always feel like white women watching me. And I got no privacy. Oh.
Of course, you not only write for Late Night with Seth Meyers, you also appear on the show, and one of your recurring segments is Jokes Seth Can't Tell. This is a segment that you do with your fellow writer, Jenny Hagel. What's the origin story of Jokes Seth Can't Tell?
Jokes Seth Can't Tell came about through Jenny. It was 100% her idea. She came to me with the idea. We wrote it up. And every Thursday, we have a sketch read where you just write up whatever's in your heart and we read it as a group.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote that up and everyone laughed. And we thought, oh, that's nice. This is something me and my friends can laugh about. This can never go on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went on the show and we thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe it made it this far. Oh, well, this was very fun. We'll certainly never do it again. And then we have done it like 20 times or something now.
So here's how this works. I'll read the setups for these jokes, and Amber and Jenny will read the punchlines. Here goes. Starbucks recently hired its first Black female COO.
Or as her co-workers call her, Venti Coco Mochaccino.
A rare white lobster was caught recently in the Gulf of Maine.
But since it was white, it got to live.
And we're still kind of learning. Every once in a while, we'll pitch a joke, and Seth will be like, you can try it if you want. I do not think it's going to hit. And he's never been wrong. You forget who done it for a million years.
Yeah.
you know, he knows.
I've read that both you and your fellow writer, Jenny Hagel, are continually shocked by what you're able to get away with saying, especially political stuff.
Every day I am freshly shocked. I cannot believe they let us behave this way. Like, it's twofold. I cannot believe people are down for the amount of silliness that I'm putting on display. And I cannot believe that they will let us talk about such touchy, important, scary issues. But they're really, you know, at the end of the day, I'm, you know, dressing up as Rockwell singing about white women calling the cops on people. You know, it's just like none of this should be okay. But because we are all being continually gaslit in this country, you have to have a release. And so because that is so necessary, because we are all so amped up over these very scary things, it means that our comedians can go even further and say even crazier things. It's kind of like what we need.
Yeah. You also have this very funny recurring segment you do called Amber Says What? How did this feature come about?
I wrote it about, I guess, the Winter Olympics. But I just, again, thought that it would just be that one thing. And I pitched that, and we all laughed, and that ended up on the show.
You guys, the Olympics were crazy. Okay, first of all, USA won its first cross-country skiing gold, and I was like, what? Then we won the gold in women's hockey, and everyone was like, what? Then 17-year-old Red Gerard overslept, lost his coat, began in last place, and ended up winning the gold for snowboarding, and everyone was like, what? But he's a snowboarder, so he was like, what? Then I saw curling, and I was like, what is this sport? And why am I so drawn to it? Then I found out a Russian curler was doping and was like, what? Why? Did you get bored?
It's really amazing how many different ways you are able to say what. And the different different ways you say it can convey so many different emotions and meanings. Could you give us a little bit of a demonstration, kind of a supercut sizzle reel, just of all the different whats, you know, the way you say them?
Oh, there's a million different ones. There's the classic what, which is the my favorite, like, quite understated what. But then there's also what, like the loud one. But then there's also just your classic what, where it's just, what has happened? What are the rules anymore? And then there's the fun, like, what?
Yeah.
You know, that's more like, hooray.
Yeah, yeah.
There, yeah. I mean, there are a million different whats to be whatted.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'm not out of what.
Yeah, yeah. My favorite segment, I think, I like love everything you've done, but I think my favorite thing that you've done so far on Seth's show is Amber's Late Night Safe Space. How did this one come about?
It was a piece where I told Seth how frustrated I was with the world and how I needed a safe space to be in where people wouldn't ask me about how I felt about, you know, dying black children and people touching my hair, and, you know, where I could just have a second.
Being black in America is tough, and people shouldn't be afraid to take the time they need to stay strong.
So now that we're here, are you upset about... I mean, why can't I say it?
This is my safe space. It won't let you say it. There's a lot of things you can't do in here. Here, try to touch my hair.
Okay. Whoa.
Yeah. Margarita?
Yeah. Are margaritas a black thing?
No. Margaritas are an amber thing. Not all black people have the same safe space, and not everything in here is a black thing. Look, here's a coaster of Chris Evans.
That's Chris Pine.
Chris something. He's cute.
I think it may be the most socially relevant and most powerful piece you've done on the show. I especially love the part where you tell Seth that not all black people have the same space and that not everything in here is a black thing. And then there's also that great exchange where Seth says he'd like to have his own safe space, and you tell him,
Seth, you're white. You have a safe space. It's called America.
What kind of feedback have you got from people about this?
Usually it's just regular folks being like, thank you for that. I didn't know that. Or thank goodness someone else also feels that way. It's usually one of those three.
Yeah. In a recent interview, Seth Meyers was asked about a group of six female comedians, and your name was one of them. And the interviewer asked Seth if he was to be replaced by any of them, who would he choose? And his response was, oh, my God, I would love to be replaced by Amber. So I'm wondering, would you like to host your own late night talk show?
I mean, gosh, yeah, I don't know. I just rewrote The Wiz.
Oh, wow.
For a production at the Muni. Which is a big theater in St. Louis. I also wrote another musical with my friend Kevin Soretta, and it is called Bigfoot, and it is about Bigfoot. It's just like the cutest little show, and it's this, you know, very fast-paced, very silly musical that ended up being timely because, you know, the town that Bigfoot came from, he's just a hairy person.
Yeah.
And he came from a town that blames all of its woes on him.
Mm.
So they force him to leave the town.
Right, but, he's become a scapegoat.
Like
yeah.
2 years ago before cool. any of this happened.
Yeah, so where...
So, like, it's just accidentally on time right now.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I'd love to see that. So, so talking about one of the many other things that Amber Ruffin is working on, you sold a show to NBC called Going Dutch. Can you tell me a bit about that?
I did. I can tell you the most important thing about it is that NBC passed on it.
Oh!
So, I did that this year.
Yeah.
I pitched them Going Dutch, a show about me and my Dutch husband and how crazy he is. He's not crazy, he's fine. And then the year before that, I pitched them a show about a black family who was famous in the 80s, like a sibling singing group.
Oh, cool.
And I passed on that. This year, I'll pitch them something that is even less likely for them to make.
Okay.
You know, we'll see how it
pans out. So maybe that's the one that they'll green light.
That would be a thing.
You're originally from one of Peyton Manning's favorite cities, Omaha, Nebraska. How do you think growing up in Omaha has influenced the way you look at the world and your comedy?
Growing up in Omaha, for me, meant growing up around a lot of white people.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I didn't get a lot of chances to be black in black spaces, and it is so important. But, you know, now I'm an adult, and I make my own dang black spaces. And, like, there is a community of us.
That's great.
That's the good thing is that I used to be alone.
Yeah.
The kind of good / bad thing is now there's, like, 12 of us.
That's great.
And we all have each other's number, and we all can hang out and go to dinner. And it's, you know, there should be more of us, but this is a very cool time to be a part of this little clique we have going. It's pretty great.
That's awesome, yeah. Final question, Amber. How important is it for you, for your comedy, to be topical and socially relevant in addition to being funny? How important is the social relevance of your comedy?
I mean, what is important to me about my comedy is, about my comedy on Late Night with Seth Meyers, is that it is about what we are thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is my favorite amount of fun. So, like, I'm just like, where do those two things meet? And that's where I always want to be, at maximum fun and maximum goof.
Amber Ruffin is a writer and performer on Late Night with Seth Meyers. Find out more about Amber at WPR.org/beta. And if you'd like to let us know what you think of the show, you can send an email to beta@WPR.org.
The first time I saw Eraserhead, I didn't know what I was looking at. Most people, I think, respond that way. But it's very powerful, and it's very seductive because it's so beautiful. It looks like it's on velvet or something.
Christine McKenna joins us to talk about the life and career of the Renaissance man of modern American filmmaking, David Lynch. That's next. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.
¶¶
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. What do you call a book that's a little bit biography and a little bit memoir? A biomoir? Or how about a mammography? I think I like mammography more than biomoir. Biomoir sounds too much like some kind of fragrance, doesn't it? Biomoir, the fragrance for the environmentally responsible man who's not afraid of being a little irresponsible after dark. The reason I'm wondering about this is because the visionary movie director David Lynch and the critic journalist Christine McKenna have collaborated on a unique hybrid that combines elements of biography and memoir. It's called Room to Dream, and it explores David Lynch's life and career. Lynch started out as a painter, but in early 1967, he decided to pursue a career as a filmmaker.
He was in a studio at the Philadelphia Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia. Oh, it was the Pennsylvania Academy. And he was working on a painting of a figure standing in green foliage, dark green foliage. And he says he heard and felt a little wind, and he detected some movement in the painting. And at that point, he thought, oh, a moving painting. And that's when he started moving towards film. And he immediately made a piece called Six Men Getting Sick, which is a short film projected onto a sculpted screen. So he kind of eased out of fine art making into film gently.
Mm-hmm. So this idea of moving paintings, as you mentioned, was a huge turning point because then David turned his attention to making films. And his debut feature film was Eraserhead, which was released in 1977. What did you think of Eraserhead the first time you saw it?
The first time I saw Eraserhead, I didn't know what I was looking at. Most people, I think, respond that way. But it's very powerful, and it's very seductive because it's so beautiful. It looks like it's on velvet or something.
Yeah.
It's a black and white film, of course. And first I was pulled in just by the beauty and the humor, because there are parts of it that are very funny. But as I became more familiar with the film, I think it's a deeply spiritual film. David says that too.
Yeah, so for those listeners who aren't familiar with Eraserhead, this is a tough question, but I know you can answer it. Can you kind of give us a brief synopsis of the film's storyline?
It's the story of Henry Spencer, who gets a girl named Mary X pregnant, and she gives birth to a deformed infant and abandons Henry with the infant, and the infant then dies. And along the way, Henry has kind of an erotic awakening with a neighbor. And through very complicated means, there's a very kind of miraculous ending, and it ends on a happy note.
Eraserhead is really, it seems, all about the mood. There's very little dialogue. The film strikes me as kind of the cinematic equivalent of a tone poem. And so much of the mood is conveyed through the soundtrack that David and Alan Splett worked so hard to create. Can you talk about the role that the soundtrack plays in Eraserhead?
Alan Splett was hugely important to David in helping him develop his ability to design sound. Alan was a real genius. They met in Philadelphia, and they kind of invented their own ways to make sound effects, because David always has such specific things, ideas in his mind when he does something. They couldn't find any recorded sound effects that matched what he needed. So he worked closely with Alan up until Blue Velvet, which Alan left because he said he couldn't work on it. It made him sick. There's a lot of like distant train whistles and barking dogs and insects, and he's very good at harvesting sound.
Yes, very much so, and marrying it so well to images.
Shortly after I started meditating, I would always do these little drawings in the food room. And one day I started drawing this little woman. And I'm drawing along, and I'm looking at this drawing, and this woman came to life in my mind. And I realized that this woman lived in Eraserhead, and that this woman lived inside the radiator.
You got your good things, and I've got mine.
You say that David's time in Philadelphia was such a contrast to his childhood, that these two experiences, his childhood and his time in Philadelphia, they combined to become one of the most enduring themes of his art. Can you explain that?
David's work is all about dualities. He had a very bucolic, nature-filled childhood with camping trips and in the country, and his father worked in a forest. And then he came to Philadelphia, which in the 60s was really a mess. The city was kind of bankrupt. They'd had race riots there. It was very violent. It was completely the opposite of anything he'd ever experienced. So those two worlds collided, and we got David Lynch.
Yeah. In much the same way that Franz Kafka's name has morphed into this adjective, Kafkaesque, David Lynch's work has spawned the word Lynchian. And in his book about David, Dennis Lim says that the paradox of the Lynchian sensibility is that it is at once easy to recognize and hard to define. In light of that, how would you define Lynchian?
Oh, gee, that's a really tough question. I'm sure really obsessive David Lynch fans notice there's a portrait of Franz Kafka on the wall in Gordon Cole's office, the FBI agent in the Twin Peaks: The Return. On the surface, Lynchian is funny because there's an element of the surreal to things that are Lynchian. But the deepest, most important part of Lynchian is beauty and embracing things that at a glance might be dismissed as ugly, seeing them as beautiful and presenting them that way. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Lynch is not afraid to follow his muse to the outskirts of his imagination and explore the weirdest ideas that he can think of. Why do you think he's able to do that?
He can go where he wants because he doesn't care what other people think. He's not afraid of poverty. He was very poor when he was a young artist coming up, and as long as he was able to make his work, that was fine. He's never been a slave to money, and so that gives him a lot of creative freedom.
Yeah, I suspect that this devil-may-care attitude may have something to do with what Nick Toscious said in his biography of Dean Martin. He said that Dean Martin had mene frigissimo, which is Italian for I don't give an F.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great book. And David's muse and his visions are so precise and strong to him, it's like he doesn't have a choice. He has to execute these things the way he sees them in his head and, you know, full steam ahead.
And lucky for us that he does that, because we're the beneficiaries of that to be able to enjoy his art.
Yes.
David Lynch's fourth feature film is Blue Velvet, which was released in 1986. What did you think of Blue Velvet the first time you saw it?
I was totally knocked out by Blue Velvet. I loved it from the start. I had the great good fortune to be on the set of that film. To me, it was the sequel to Eraserhead. Dune and The Elephant Man were strange little kinds of forks in the road for David. They weren't really conventional David projects, but Blue Velvet was really building on the promise of Eraserhead to me and going deeper, and I just loved it.
For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with Blue Velvet, can you give us kind of a brief summary of what happens in Blue Velvet?
Blue Velvet is the story of Jeffrey Beaumont, a college student whose father suffers a heart attack, so he comes home from school to a small town where they live, Lumberton. And he finds a severed ear in a field and takes it to the police and starts delving deeper into the mystery of what caused this ear to end up in a field. And along the way, he has an erotic awakening, kind of not unlike Henry Spencer's. Jeffrey Beaumont is kind of like when David got to Philadelphia. He was this wide-eyed boy who suddenly is confronted with the violence and ugliness in the world, and that's kind of the story.
That's very well said, and I love what you mentioned a moment ago, that in many ways Blue Velvet is kind of a sequel to Eraserhead. Blue Velvet was very controversial when it was released, and film critic Roger Ebert was especially upset. What did he say about it?
He felt it was very misogynistic, and I can't remember his exact quote, but it was something along the lines of, if a director asks Isabella Rossellini to go through what she has to go through in this film, he should at least put her in a film that's worth it, and David did not. Yeah, he was very incensed. I think because Isabella is very vulnerable in it, and she shows her body in a way that's not contextualized as this is a beautiful woman's body. It's an image of abuse in the film.
Yeah, yeah, and yet film critic David Thompson, who just recently, within the last few days, wrote a review of your book in which he said that Blue Velvet is a work of American art to be considered in the same league as Charles Ives' work, Edward Hopper, and William Faulkner's.
I know, I loved that review, and I loved that comment, and I agree with him completely.
Alan Splett, the audio genius we were talking about earlier, he worked with David on Blue Velvet, and together they created this very innovative audioscape we were talking a bit about earlier in the context of Eraserhead. David's and Alan's remarkable ability to marry sound and images. Can you give me a few examples of their creative sound design in Blue Velvet?
There's a love scene between Kyle MacLachlan and Isabella, and the sound to that is like screeching metal that kind of merges into the roar of a lion. It's very dark and sinister and frightening. Most of the sounds are kind of that way. There's another, when we first see the ear in the field, the camera travels into the ear and goes deeper and deeper into the darkness in the ear. And there's kind of like a deep wind that just gets broader and deeper the deeper you go into the ear. It's very beautiful.
Can you talk a bit about the working relationship between David Lynch and his longtime music composer, Angelo Badalamenti?
Well, it was kismet when they met. Most people know how Angelo came into David's life. Isabella had to deliver a rendition of Blue Velvet in the film, and she was having a hard time singing it, so the producer of the film, Fred Caruso, brought his friend Angelo Badalamenti down from New York. And Angelo, through his great patience and sensitivity, managed to get an incredible performance out of Isabella, and the first just practice take that they put down on tape, David ended up using in the film.
She
the opening titles of the film, originally he had Shostakovich playing, and David said to Angelo, "Can you give me that?" And Angelo said, "Well, I can't compose like Shostakovich, but I can give you that quote-unquote Russian sound," which he did. He can kind of do anything. And so David and Angelo write together, and David talks what he's feeling, and Angelo plays music on a keyboard as David's talking, and that's how they've created their music.
David breathed new life into his 1990 TV series, Twin Peaks, with co-creator Mark Frost, with this third season, long-awaited third season that aired on Showtime last year. Why do you think he wanted to return to the Twin Peaks story world?
He was still in love with that town. Those people are very real to him, the Palmers, and they're like real people to him, and he wasn't done with that world. That's why he did Fire Walk With Me after the second season of Twin Peaks ended. As he said, he wasn't ready to leave that world. And he's never abandoned those characters. They've remained alive in his mind to him, and so he had more to say about it. I mean, if all the stars lined up right, I wouldn't be surprised if he did more, but I know right now he's very involved in painting, and that's what he wants to do, so I don't think it's going to happen this year.
And the feeling in my head is that this day in front of me is like there's a gorge, a gigantic canyon, like the Grand Canyon. And there's a very, very delicate glass bridge that goes from this side to the other side. And that represents the work that needs to be done. You get to the location or the set, and it's a big process. It's a big machine that needs to move forward.
Got a light? Got a light? Got a light?
Christine McKenna is the co-author, along with David Lynch, of the biography memoir, Room to Dream. Find out more at WPR.org /beta.
There is such a really vital exploration of these parts of himself. He does it in such an artful and sonically fascinating and unpredictable way that it's almost impossible not to be transfixed.
Kirk Walker Graves explains why My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is Kanye West's masterpiece. That's next. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. All of the lights. Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. In 2009, rapper Kanye West retreated to Hawaii. In the wake of several high-profile national broadcast embarrassments, he began to work on his next record. The result of his exile was the album My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. It became West's masterpiece. The premier music site Pitchfork.com awarded the album the rare perfect score. Writer Kirk Walker Graves has written the 33 and a third book on the record. He joins us now to discuss the instant classic and how it served not only as a milestone in hip-hop and pop music, but also as an artistic atonement for Kanye's public outbursts.
One of the testaments to My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy's greatness is that I think it's sort of an artistic kind of self-acquittal. With that record, there wasn't any artifice in the sense that he was truly, I think, explaining himself the only way that he knew how to explain himself, and that was obviously aesthetically. And the record is a testament to that. It's excessively long. It's almost 70 minutes. It's opulent. There are dozens upon dozens upon dozens of collaborators. It's full of spontaneity. It's full of surprises. It's full of grotesque moments and sublime moments. And it has this sort of gargantuan human comedy element to it that I think I certainly have yet to encounter on another record in this century, at least. And I think that is kind of the reason that it's resonated so much. I know that I think Chris Rock, who appears on one of the tracks on Blame Game, I think he said that he believes it's the most significant record of the 2000s, certainly.
Would you agree with that?
Century.
Would you agree with that?
I think it's up there. Yeah. It's hard to say. The ranking game is kind of increasingly a fool's errand. I think we have so much more access to so much more information, and the reason that all these subgenres exist now is because I think we are just more refined and specific in our taste. But I think certainly if I were going to make a monolithic claim of that nature, I would definitely put MBDTF in the running.
Yeah, and yet, despite his massive ego, Kanye West, in a lot of his music, he's exploring self-doubt, isn't he? How do you explain that?
He is. He's exploring self-doubt, and again, I think that willingness to go to those places and that willingness to really cling to vulnerability like a plank after a shipwreck, I think that people relate to that. I know that I did, and have had certainly multiple instances in my own life when that was sort of a survival mechanism, and I think he does that on that record so well, and it comes across sort of most most profoundly in Runaway, which is sort of the album's kind of emotional centerpiece, and the music, there's a music video, or it's really a short film that was sort of like a compendium of music videos that he co-directed, and it was just called Runaway. That was sort of part of the album's launch, and it's known now for having the iconic ballerinas who are dancing while he's playing piano and singing, and it's one of the most gorgeous, if in my opinion, pop creations that I've ever seen to this day. I mean, it can still make the hair in the back of my neck stand up when I hear those first few notes in Runaway, that stark piano. That song really is about self-doubt, self-disavowal, And really, it's just this naked, almost embarrassingly, uncomfortably honest plea for freedom. And I think you don't hear that on many hip-hop tracks, certainly, and really in popular music to that extent. There is such a really vital exploration of these parts of himself that I think most of us, I think, would be loath to represent that way. And again, he does it in such an artful and sonically fascinating and unpredictable way that it's almost impossible not to be transfixed. Run away fast as you
can. Let's talk about the opening track of My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. It's a song called Dark Fantasy. Can you tell me a bit about this one?
Yeah, I can. Dark Fantasy is the first track on the record. It's obviously much like the introduction to a fairy tale in that it begins with kind of a perverse interpolation of Roald Dahl's poem Cinderella from his book Revolting Rhymes, which is a 1982 collection of some revisionist fairy tales.
You might think you've peeped the scene. You haven't. The real one's far too mean. The watered-down one, the one you know, was made up centuries ago. They made it sound all whack and corny. Yes, it's awful, blasted, boring. Twisted fiction, sick addiction. Well, gather round, children, zip it, listen.
Can we get much higher? So
high. This track is sort of a self-assessment. It has kind of a very focused confidence that I think is not really present on every track. Part of the beauty of this record is that there is something of a kind of a these schizophrenic sort of levels of intensity in different tracks and multiple personalities almost depending on which moment we find Kanye in. This track is kind of an opening statement, sort of setting. It samples vocals from former Yes lead singer John Anderson, and there's a Mike Oldfield song from 1983 called In High Places, and that opening sample is asking, can we get much higher? And there's this sense of aspiration that really defines the song and kind of sort of sets the tone for the rest of the record. There's this sense of you're about to sort of enter a really intense ride and hold on as tight as you can.
Can we get much higher?
Let's talk about the song Power. Can you kind of walk us through Power? Because this is really one of the more important songs on the album, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. In the book, I use sort of the Shelley poem Ozymandias as kind of a prism through which to view Power, because it's very much about how fraught power is with its own fear of destruction. Mm-hmm. And the poem has always struck me as really one of the more overlooked poems for life, I think. Mm-hmm. We get our Robert Frost doses a lot, and I had to read that, I think, in high school, but it always stayed with me. And when I heard Power for the first time, I thought of that. And around the same time that I was writing the book, I think Breaking Bad, the show, was wrapping up, and there was a voiceover of Bryan Cranston in that wonderfully gravelly, just omniscient voice as Walter White sort of reading a stanza of Ozymandias and sort of the idea of empire inevitably kind of bearing the seeds of its own eventual destruction.
Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
I'm living in that 21st century, doing something mean to it, do it better than anybody you ever seen do it.
It just fit, and so that song in particular really is the arc, I think, of how Kanye sort of perceives his career. I think that he had achieved a certain status and level of fame and notoriety and even kind of cultural acclaim and achievement. But in the wake of all of the outbursts and the incidents and sort of dealing with his own kind of irascibility, he's sort of struggling to make sense of it. And there's you know, that song is dark. When there's toward the end of the song, there's a suicidal ideation, a fantasy of jumping through the window and kind of, you know, sort of falling to his own demise. The invocation by, you know, Ozymandias, this long, long, long dead king, you know, sort of boasting about his reign being forever. There's a self-awareness and power that I think Kanye sees the fragility of his own status, and I think that's bound up so intimately with this record. It's almost impossible to understand the record without understanding his own awareness of not only his own ego fragility, but also his status, or whether he's beloved or a pariah. I think he knows that none of those things are constants, and powers, it's not permanent.
I wanted to ask you about the song Lost in the World. The success of this song has a lot to do with Justin Vernon of Bon Iver, who, of course, is from our neck of the woods here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Can you talk a bit about Kanye and Justin, how they worked together to create this song?
My understanding is that Kanye—I know Kanye's claimed in the past that his favorite artist is Justin Vernon and how much he loves the music of Bon Iver. From what I understand, he sort of contacted Vernon and said, you know, I'm making this album in Hawaii. I would love to fly you out here, and would love to sort of get you know, some contributions from you. And I know that Justin Vernon has gone on record talking about when they were laying down the vocal tracks for Lost in the World, and Kanye sort of wanting it thicker, you know, saying it's not thick enough. I want it thicker. And you know what happens is just this unbelievably transcendent alchemy in that song. The introduction is Bon Iver initially singing in this auto-tuned voice that he's, you know, he's sort of a master of. He's his song Woods,
right,
off of his EP Blood Bank,
yeah,
and which is one of my favorite Bon Iver, you know, tracks anyway. But
oh sure,
it sort of subtly, ever so subtly, shifts into a thicker vocal, and eventually it merges sort of with not Up in the Woods, but Lost in the World.
To slow down time, I'm up in the woods, I'm down on my land, I'm building a still down the time, I'm lost in the world.
There's this sense of Kanye making this final claim, sort of, you know, again, this album is an aesthetic self-acquittal of sorts for his own personality. If it's kind of an apology record in that sense, but it also sort of making a claim. I still can't get enough of that track, and so yeah, that track is really kind of all about fusing these binaries within Kanye's personality. And to me, the song has this sort of swirling feel when he's the part where he's actually, you know, rapping, you know, and he's sort of listing these opposites. It has this, whenever I hear it, I kind of see it like a DNA coil, that kind of helix, and these binaries trying to fuse. And it's just, I don't know, there's just something that's intoxicating about that track.
You're my devil, you're my angel, you're my heaven, you're my hell, you're my now, you're my forever, you're my freedom, you're my jail, you're my lies, you're my truth, you're my war, you're my truth, you're my questions, you're my proof, you're my stress and your mama suits. Mama say, mama mock the sun, lost in this plastic life, let's break out of this.
The final track is called Who Will Survive in America, and the title comes from the American soul and jazz poet Gil Scott Heron sample that basically makes up the track. What's your take on this one?
This track being the coda to the entire record, this being the final theme that we hear, I think that there's something kind of pulsating and tribal And, you know, certainly tribalism is part of our politics now.
Oh, yeah.
It seems permanently. And I think that that question, which unfortunately is probably more easily answerable for some now than for others, I think it really it resonates. I mean, this record was recorded, you know, it came out 8 years ago. But, you know, hearing Scott Herron sort of just machine gunning that question, who will survive in America?
Mm-hmm.
Who will survive in America? It's chilling. He's using Gil Scott Heron's poetry to ask a question about himself and his own role, and the role for people who feel creatively infinite and unbounded, but who are going to run into the same constraints he has. And so, I don't know, I find it an outward-looking, somber, and appropriate coda for the record. I think it's kind of, it just feels right.
Kirk Walker Graves is the author of Kanye West's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. It's part of the 33 and a Third series. That does it for this edition of Beta, but it doesn't do it for you. Keep in touch with us during the week on Twitter, at WPRBeta, or send us a note. Just email it to beta@WPR.org. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
That's just flavor to a high life man.
Special thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher.
If you don't enjoy the doing, then do something else.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I don't really want to be Adam this year.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm
I'm really happy for you. I'll let you finish.
Gordon.